everybody. I'm Ashwin. This is Blood Cancer Talks. This is a podcast exclusively dedicated to hematologic malignancies, where we bring content experts who live and breathe a particular disease and focus on the latest advances in biology and clinical management. Today, we are excited to talk about the management of essential thrombocythemia. We have an expert, Dr. Rajit Rampal, who is the director of the Center for Hematologic Malignancies and the director of Myeloproliferative Neoplasm Program at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York City. Dr. Rampal, thank you so much for joining us and thank you for your time. Before we start, can you tell us about yourself and your clinical and research focus for our listeners?
Yeah, my pleasure to be here. Of course, you and I have known each other for more than a decade at this point, as you were going through your training. So it's definitely a pleasure to be here. I'm a physician scientist working in MPNs. I do preclinical work with mouse models and genetics, but I also run the clinical trials program at MSK. And clinically, of course, I see much of my practice is MPNs, of course, AML and MDS as well. But I've been caring for these patients for more than a decade now. And, it's an exciting area in MPNs at this time. Still a lot to be done and a lot to learn, but certainly an exciting time.
You wear many hats. You do lab-based research as well as clinical research. And at the same time, you take care of patients as well.
No question.
All right. Okay. So with that, let's jump right in. We'll start with the case and you can walk us through how you would approach this patient and we can discuss the data as we go. So this is a case I actually seen in the clinic. Obviously, I changed some of the patient identifiers. So this is a 29-year-old female with no significant past medical history, was referred by a primary care physician for a persistent elevation of platelet count. That's why she was referred to the hematologist, that is me. So her complete blood count at the time of presentation showed a white blood cell count of 6.9, hemoglobin of 14.5, hematocrit 42, and a platelets of 665,000. Upon further review, patient was noted to have persistent thrombocytosis more than 450,000 for the past 6 months. Mm-hmm. And she also had a ultrasound done before presenting to me, which showed a splenomegaly of 14.9 centimeters. So with the persistent elevation of platelet count and the ultrasound showing splenomegaly, we pursued diagnostic test, the bone marrow aspiration biopsy, which showed a normocellular marrow with trilineage hematopoiesis. There was a megakaryocytic hyperplasia and ATPia. Megakaryocytes demonstrate clustering and significant size and shape variation, including forms with Stagon nuclei. That is the exact description the pathologist mentioned in the note. And there was no fibrosis noted. So in a case like this, other thing I forgot to mention is the myeloid NGS panel showed a JAK2 V617 of mutation with a variant allele frequency of 38%. So in a case like this, how would you approach a patient like this when you see a patient in the clinic? Can you please walk us through your thought process and the diagnosis test you will order?
Well, I think, if we take a step back and we think about the case, one wants to always not assume that this is ET, right? The common thing is elevated platelets, JAK2, this is ET. Is that true? It may not be true. And the things one has to think about carefully, especially in a young female patient, is this masked polycythemia? If the patient has, for example, a history of menorrhagia, could the patient actually be iron deficient and having a secondary or reactive thrombocytosis as well as an underlying polycythemia that's not being manifested because the patient is already iron deficient? So this is one thing one wants to think about carefully. And taking a careful menstrual history is important. Making sure that you check the iron studies is very important, right? So that's one part of the differential you want to think about. The second thing you want to think about in the differential, right? If we stay within the world of MPNs, you always want to, of course, think about excluding CML because early on thrombocytosis could be the presentation. So, of course, checking for a BCR-ABL, and of course, there are rare cases where these things overlap. And then finally, I think you need to think carefully about pre-fibrotic myelofibrosis, which can early on manifest very much like ET, high platelets. Usually, there's some, other findings like a slightly elevated white count or LDH is elevated. And in this case, with the spleen being slightly elevated, I mean, nothing really that remarkable from this report. I think that would raise your suspicion. So, kind of taking a step back, those are the diagnostic considerations, and those are the reasons to me that that validates doing the bone marrow assessment. In this particular case, right, you have very much a classical description of ET, right? This is normocellular, whereas PV and prefibrotic MF are hypercellular, classically. And then with the Staghorn nuclei, that's almost pathognomonic for ET, right? So everything kind of fits for ET in this particular sense. I think the only things that are a little bit odd to me are the VAF of the JAK2 is a little bit higher than I would expect for ET. And the mild splenomegaly. And in that regard, it's important to remember that rarely, not often, but rarely, ET can actually ultimately progress to polycythemia vera. It happens more in younger patients. It's not a common event, but it happens. So those are the sort of diagnostic considerations. From a therapeutic perspective, right? If this is a patient who has no thrombotic or bleeding history, no symptoms, but is JAK2 mutated, right? We would think about this patient in the risk scoring stratification. And the current risk stratification that we use with regards to thrombosis risk is based on the mutations and age. And so we used to be in a situation where we put any people into high risk and low risk, but not anymore. It really depends on the genetics. And then a JAK2 mutated patients, high risk and low risk is really the way we think about it. But if they have other mutations like calreticulin, then there are very low risk and there's intermediate risk, and that influences how you treat the patient. But in this patient, everything being equal, this is somebody who we would call probably low risk. Aspirin is a very reasonable intervention. No more than 81 milligrams is needed, but 181 BID could be considered, but certainly no reason for a full dose aspirin. And then the other last, piece of therapeutic intervention is lifestyle, right? We don't talk to patients enough about this. And, even in a young patient, you have to think about making sure the patient is staying on top of their cholesterol, their weight, not taking up smoking, all of the things that add to thrombotic risk for anybody in the general population. These are things we have to counsel the patients on when they have a diagnosis of MPN.
I think you touched on some of the very important and salient points in management of ET. One thing I personally struggle with, and this is something I see a lot of anxiety in patients as well. What is the particular threshold of platelet count in ET you are worried about? Because I've seen different clinicians giving this arbitrary platelet threshold, some saying that a 1 million platelet threshold is when I would initiate treatment if the patient does not have any history of thrombosis. So is there a particular threshold of platelet count you're worried about? Or is there a correlation between platelet count and the thrombosis, which is an important thing we are worried about in ET patients?
It's a good question, right? So the interesting thing is there is no correlation between platelet count and thrombosis. None has existed. No, there's no data to support that. Bleeding, on the other hand, yes. As the platelet count rises, the risk of bleeding increases. And the particular risk is the development of acquired von Willebrand deficiencies. There's a high molecular weight multimers that get adsorbed by the platelets, and so you end up with an essentially functional von Willebrand deficiency. That you have to think about looking for once the platelets reach about a million. Right now, it doesn't have to be a million exactly, 900 or there. I always check that because that can happen, and that is a reason to start cytoreduction. There are, we have the so-called platelet millionaires, right? The people who are walking around with over a million platelets. If there's no hemostatic defect, no acquired von Willebrand disease, you do not automatically have to do anything. There is no data that says that you're going to help that patient. By reducing their platelet count in the absence of there being symptoms or bleeding or history of bleeding or thrombosis. So it scares people to see the number. It scares physicians, it scares patients. But the reality is that there isn't anything to say that reacting to the number is helping the patient, right? I think that's where we have to kind of take a pause, and sometimes the right thing to do is just put your hands in your pockets and wait. And that's a situation like that.
Is there any correlation between platelet count and symptom burden?
Is it, yeah, also an interesting question. I think the answer to from experience is largely no. I mean, I've seen people with mildly elevated platelets who are having erythromelalgia or having migraines, and sometimes the patients with 1.2 million platelets are fine. So not precisely. But again, the point you're making that I think is an important take-home point is to make sure that you assess the symptom burden in the patients, right? Because that is an important part of this.
What are the some of the symptoms you ask whenever an ET patient presents to your clinic?
Definitely erythromelalgia, headaches that are new, particularly migraine headaches, abdominal pain, particularly after eating, which could be vascular, could be due to spleen or liver, fatigue, which is a very common complaint that patients have, itching less so, but sometimes you will see it in even ET patients. That's sort of some of the general things I tend to ask. And then bruising, bleeding, that type of thing.
And one other thing is the median age of diagnosis is between 60 to 70 years, with a small peak in women of reproductive age. Is there a biologic difference in disease severity between these two different age groups?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that there is, right? At the onset. And I certainly have a clinic full of young people with ET who by the textbooks they shouldn't have it, but they do. And I think you see a lot of very different things, right? But it isn't that I can pinpoint there to be a specific difference at the time of outset. The thing that I think one has to think about is extent of risk over time, right? In a young person, there is more opportunity for other events to occur, be it genetic events or clinical events, whereas somebody who's diagnosed older probably has a shorter amount. And then, of course, you have to think about, things like clonal hematopoiesis. Is this occurring in the background of clonal hematopoiesis, or are there other mutations that are occurring concurrently in an older versus younger patient? But yeah, I think that's sort of the way I think about it.
One other important point you mentioned is to differentiate based on bone marrow biopsy between ET and prefibrotic myelofibrosis. Why the differentiation is important?
Yeah, no, I think not for the man. Currently, we manage those patients as we do ET. Now, is that the right thing to do? I don't know. I think we need to figure that out. The prognosis, though, is different, right? There is a higher rate of progression to fulminant myelofibrosis. There's a higher rate of progression to AML. It's not a very high risk, right? You're going from 2 to probably around 8% risk of leukemia at 10 years. So it's not a very high risk, but I think it does. The prognosis does change, and you're now dealing with myelofibrosis, be it on the lower end of the spectrum, but that may open up other opportunities for treatment. It may prompt one to treat, but the disease diagnosis by itself is not enough to change the
All
management.
right, before going to risk stratification, I had just one question, maybe a naive question. Sometimes in diagnosis of PV, we don't always need a bone marrow biopsy. But for ET, do we definitely need a bone marrow biopsy at diagnosis, or it's something that's optional?
I think I encourage patients to get it, right? Even if everything else fits, because you don't know until you know, right? At the end of the day, until you do the marrow, you don't actually know what the diagnosis is. And I have plenty of examples of patients who have been walking around with a diagnosis of ET for a few years. They see us for a second opinion. We do a marrow. It's not ET. It's prefibrotic MF, or there's something else going on that wasn't expected. So I think that's important. The other thing to remember, of course, is if things change over time, it's good to know where you started from, right? Now the patient is 10 years into this, counts are different, and we see that there's fibrosis. How much was there at the beginning, right? It helps you give some perspective in terms of where you were. Is it an absolute necessity? No, it's not. Does it clarify the diagnosis and potentially prognosis? Yes.
Right, yeah, that's very helpful. So, before we recommend therapy, we need to risk stratify our patients. So, what are the prognostic factors that you use to risk stratify patients with ET?
Yeah, so I mean, it's their presence or absence of thrombotic history, presence or absence of JAK2 versus calreticulin or MPL mutations. Those are the key things, right? And so you end up with high risk, intermediate risk, low risk, very low risk. And really, at this point, only high risk patients require cytoreduction, whereas everybody else really just requires an aspirin. There's some thought that maybe even the very low risk patients don't even need the aspirin, but that needs to be, I think, further substantiated. But yes, I think that's exactly correct, right? We stratify, and then that tells us sort of how to treat the patient.
Right, and what is the risk of progression to things like post ET myelofibrosis or MDS or AML that we usually worry about?
Across the board, it really is under 10% for both, 2% or so for AML, and around 8 to 10% for myelofibrosis. But of course, the time that you have the disease matters, right? Number one. Number two, there is some data now that perhaps mutations make a difference, i.e., you can further risk stratify patients based on their genetics, and things like splicing factor mutations and potentially p53 mutations seem to be associated with a higher risk of progression, right? So yes, we lump everybody for in terms of progression MF or to AML. Or MF into one basket and say this is the mean, but you can probably break that down further and say there are, within that group, patients who are more likely to progress based on the genetics.
Right, as you said, genetics. Can you touch upon what are the risk stratification systems in ET? Like the revised IPSET or the MIPS ET?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, MIPS-ET was the genetically inspired one. This was published by the Mayo Clinic Group, and their data was validated from the Italian groups. Which I think that needs further that has to be further validated, right, in other data sets and bigger numbers of patients. IPSET is, as we were just talking about, IPSET is really for thrombosis risk, and that is the high to very low risk stratification tool that we use.
So, in your clinic, do you always get a full myeloid NGS panel for all patients you're suspecting of ET?
Absolutely, yes.
And how does that help you?
I think that, if there are other mutations present, then certainly with the molecular inspired risk scoring systems, it gives you some perspective. Is this a patient who's more likely to progress? Are you going to do anything different about it? No, probably not, right? I think you have to think about that. And so is it, again, it comes down to the question of, is it an absolute necessity? Probably not, right? You need to make the diagnosis, you need to find the driver mutation. Do you have to know everything else in every single patient? No, not necessarily. I think it's hard to argue that right now if you're not going to do anything with that information. But I think having that information can be useful.
We'll move forward with the management of ET patients. I think you briefly touched upon. When a patient with ET presents in your clinic, how do you discuss the management? Like, are there any particular goals do you set with the patient that these are things need to be achieved so that we need to monitor for these and these and these particular signs or symptoms?
Symptoms are a big part of it, right? Because symptoms like having erythromelalgia or having migraines, whatever it is, those can be reasons to initiate cytoreductive therapy aside from just aspirin-based therapy. But in somebody who's in the high-risk category, we want to cytoreduce them and control their platelets. To what extent, this is not very clear, right? There is no set clear platelet threshold where we define success. I think we just want to control the platelet count. And that's the message we give the patients, right? There isn't a perfect here. We don't want to, drive down the platelet count to the point where we're making patients anemic because, again, what are we achieving without any evidence? So I think those are the things we talk about. So really, it's a question of do you need cytoreduction or not? And even within thinking about aspirin, in patients who are on aspirin and are having erythromelalgia, sometimes doing BID dosing with aspirin will alleviate that. So there is a role for BID aspirin. So you have to think about the aspirin dosing and you have to think about the intervention with cytoreductive therapy.
So mostly use twice daily aspirin only for patients who have symptoms from the disease. Other than every patient with ET gets once a day aspirin.
So, right, it is a good question because there is biochemical data, right, that would suggest that to get proper inhibition twice a day would be needed. Now, I think the issue is that the clinical data is not entirely there that says to us patients who get BID aspirin are going to do better, have less thrombotic risk, all of that, than the patients who are getting once a day aspirin. Nonetheless, yeah, in standard practice, I only at this point use once daily aspirin. But if symptoms occur, then I will go to BID. In many cases, that alleviates symptoms.
Is there any data supporting the use of other antiplatelet agents such as clopidogrel in ET?
Not really much. It's aspirin has been the most well-studied drug in this space.
Now, moving forward with the cytoreduction, what are the some of the agents do you use routinely for cytoreduction in ET?
We have a couple of agents, right? So hydroxyurea is, I think, probably the most widely used agent. We have pegylated interferons, and now the ropeg interferon is under investigation in this area. And then we have anagrelide, which is an old drug, but it's still a very useful drug. There is off-label use of ruxolitinib that's been reported in several studies, including a randomized study, but it is not FDA approved for this indication. So something that, sometimes it does get used in a refractory situation, but in most patients, I think hydroxyurea, anagrelide, or interferon are the drugs of choice.
So when you initiate for example, hydroxyurea, which is usually the first line you use versus pegylated interferon, how do you choose between these two agents, hydroxyurea versus pegylated interferon?
Well, there's limited data. I mean, the agents have been compared head to head in, for example, the MPNRC 112 study, which didn't really find much difference in 2 years. But we know that interferon takes a while to work. It takes a while to get allele burden reduction. It takes a while to control the counts. So we have to put that data in the context of that of historical data, like in the sense that it takes time for these drugs to work. In younger patients, I tend to favor interferon. Because but there is the opportunity potentially to reduce the frequency of dosing and maybe in some patients even stop dosing after a while. Whereas hydroxyurea, once you're on it, you're on it. And in most cases, you really can't down titrate it without incurring an increase in the platelets. For older patients, hydroxyurea is a reasonable drug. And for patients, who are having any side effects from either medication, anagrelide is a reasonable choice as well.
When you initiate, for example, hydroxyurea, is there a particular platelet threshold you're targeting for these patients, or it's just a complete remission of the symptoms is what you're targeting? What are your particular goal when you initiate treatment?
Yeah, and again, I think here is where there's a lack of robust data in terms of what your platelet count should be, right? We try to keep it, somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 to 600, if possible. I think that has been our practice. Again, there are some retrospective series that say less than 600 or less than 400 are more associated with a decrease in thrombotic events. So I think from that, we extrapolate our goal, which I think, sort of between 400 and 600.
What are some of the side effects of hydroxyurea you discuss with patients with ET?
It can cause mouth ulcers, it can cause skin ulcers. There's an increased risk of skin cancer. So one of the important things is anybody that we put on hydroxyurea, we recommend they see a dermatologist once a year. That's our standard practice. Fevers are not really common. They can happen. GI side effects, not really common. They can happen maybe 20% of patients. Hair thinning, hair loss, all of those are major side effects.
I know some of the clinicians, and especially in the community, mentioned about increased risk of leukemia transformation with hydroxyurea. What is your take on it?
There really isn't conclusive data. And this subject comes up, and this is a concern for patients and physicians, which I think is a legitimate thing, right? But there isn't any conclusive data that there is an increased risk of leukemic progression with hydroxyurea. On the other hand, there is data that MPN patients exposed to hydroxyurea may have a higher rate of developing p53 mutations, which, of course, is not generally a good thing, right? So to me, that's maybe the caveat here is, are you putting pressure on selection of certain clones? like P53 mutations. I think that is a concern for which there is some evidence.
You mentioned about pegylated interferon and the MPDRC112 clinical trial. There is also some evidence showing that with use of pegylated interferon, there is a greater reduction in JAK2V617F allele burden, especially at the 2 year time point. What is the significance of this molecular response?
We don't know. Maybe is the only real answer I can give you, right? Let's extrapolate from other things. What we've seen with PV recently, right? Very recent paper with Rux-treated patients with PV is that the reduction in JAK2 allele burden correlated with a reduction in clinical events like progression-free survival, leukemic transformation, these types of things. Now, does that data exist in ET? No, not necessarily. And I mean, one has to think about the extent of the reduction. Maybe that's the way to think about it, right? You think about CML, where we're getting log order reductions. Here we're getting modest reductions, 10-20%. So, do those things correlate with a clinically meaningful outcome? We'd like to think so, but do we have, a profound amount of data that that's true? No, we don't, right? Again, there is emerging data from PV that is beginning to suggest to us that there may be important correlates of having an allele burden reduction. I think we're lacking that data in ET right now.
Do you measure JAK2 allele burden in patients who are on treatment with ET?
By request, I think is the
Yeah.
answer. If patients are interested for it, I'll do it, right?
Exactly,
I mean,
yeah.
I do think, and this is a separate topic, a separate discussion, is there a role for serial genomic testing in these patients? I think potentially there is. We need to show that that actually is of clinical meaning to do that. But yeah, in most cases, I don't, because it's not going to change my management.
And any of the side effects you discuss with patients who are on pegylated interferon?
That can be more of a range, right? So there is, people can have LFT abnormalities, thyroid abnormalities. They can develop very rarely pulmonary fibrosis and ocular toxicities. We worry about depression. That can sometimes occur under 10% of patients, but that can be substantial. Injection site reactions and itching. I think that's the other thing that sometimes isn't well appreciated is interferon. People can become very pruritic from the injection. So those are kind of the major side effects we counsel patients on.
And talking about the third agent you mentioned is anagrelide. When do you use anagrelide in the management of ET?
I think anagrelide can be useful in a number of different ways, right? So for example, if a patient, let's say an older patient has intolerance to hydroxyurea, can you switch them to anagrelide rather than interferon? Yes, I think that makes sense in that circumstance. In patients who are incurring anemia as a result of the hydroxyurea being used to treat their ET, sometimes anagrelide can be very useful in that particular circumstance. You can get anemia with anagrelide, but it tends to occur years into treatment, whereas early on it's not such an issue, right? So I think I use it mostly as a second line agent if I can't get a patient to tolerate hydroxyurea or even interferon, and I don't want to use one of those other agents, not so much as a first line agent.
And what are some of the side effects of anagrelide?
It can cause palpitations in some patients. Some patients will actually have somewhat of an increase in bone marrow fibrosis, but it tends to be transient. It can be cumbersome to take in the sense that you can give it once a day, but often you've got to go twice a day, but you can give it up to four times a day. And that's very hard for anybody to take a medicine four times a day, right? So that can make it a little bit more cumbersome.
Do you ever combine such as hydroxyurea in combination with anagrelide to control their platelet count?
Absolutely. I think that's a situation where sometimes you're getting close to the max dose that you want to use for one given drug like hydroxyurea. In that case, adding an anagrelide to allow you to lower the dose of the hydroxyurea is a very reasonable thing to do.
One other agent I want to briefly talk about is busulfan. There are some institutions who still use busulfan to control the platelet count. Is there any data to use busulfan in management of ET?
There is, right? I mean, busulfan can be a useful agent in an elderly patient, somebody in their mid-80s who, let's just say, has had lots of skin cancer, can't tolerate Hydrea, not a candidate for interferon, has had palpitations. And I've seen patients like this, right? I mean, these are not a large number of patients, but it happens, right, where you don't really have any other choices, and their busulfan can be useful. There is, it's an alkylating agent, of course, and there is a concern for leukemic progression, which I think is a real concern. But for somebody whose lifespan perhaps is otherwise limited and you just need to control their counts, it can be a very useful drug.
Now, talking about ruxolitinib, like you briefly mentioned about the MAGIC-ET study, which is a randomized phase two study comparing ruxolitinib with the best available therapy, which include hydroxyurea, pegylated interferon, as well as anagrelide. Unfortunately, the MAGIC-ET study did not meet its endpoint. Both the rux treatment as well as the best available therapy treatment had similar response. And I think 46% in the Rux group and 44 in the standard group. There was no statistical significant difference between the two groups. In addition, there was no difference was up in the rate of thrombosis, hemorrhage, and disease transformation after 2 years follow-up. And even the molecular responses were also very same between these two groups. But I think the only thing we saw in the published data is the Rux was superior in symptom management. What is your take of ruxolitinib with ET, and why do you think that the MAGIC-ET failed to show any response?
Rux has been, like if you think about other diseases, like even PV, right? Oftentimes when we use Rux for PV, you don't necessarily get good platelet count control. So that's always been a challenge. And I think the same is true in ET. You don't always get robust platelet count reduction like you do with hematocrit, for example, right? Or even white blood count. So I think that may be part of the issue. It depends on how you want to interpret the MAGIC study in the sense that on one hand, there's really no difference, which says to me that it's an active agent, that you could use it, right? That it has similar efficacy, maybe some superiority in terms of symptom profile. So from that standpoint, it becomes a drug in the arsenal that can be useful. Again, off-label use, let's just be clear about that, in certain circumstances. But certainly it has not shown superiority the way that Rux has done in PV.
One question regarding allogeneic transplant. Do you refer ET patients who are medically fit for allogeneic transplant evaluation? Do you use some kind of risk stratification to refer high-risk patients for allogeneic transplant?
No, if we're just purely talking about ET, then no, we don't refer patients to transplant, right? Again, everything is a risk and benefit, right? And you're talking about with a transplant, maybe a 20% risk of mortality up front, not to mention the GVH risks, and it's exceedingly uncommon, right, that a PV that an ET patient is going to have events that would justify taking that risk, right? MF, different story, but for ET, generally, no.
In terms of talking about future directions, any exciting clinical trials in newly diagnosed ET you're eagerly awaiting results for?
There's a couple of things that are emerging, right? So, of course, we've talked about interferon and its role in ET, but now ropeg interferon, which is FDA approved for PV, is being studied in ET. And the advantage of that is it's an every 2 week dosing versus every week with pegylated interferon. So, more to come on that. There's studies ongoing with that agent in ET. And one of the interesting things is that there was data presented not in 2023 ASCO EHA, but it was 2022 EHA and ASCO for the BET inhibitor being used as a single agent in ET, in which there were some responses seen. Platelet counts, did come down. It remains to be seen if that's going to be a future direction, for that for pelabresib. But nonetheless, at least there was some activity there.
And any role of bomedemstat, LSD1 and the better.
Bomedemstat has been studied in this space, with an interesting dosing strategy in the sense that dosing is actually titrated to the platelet count, right? In other words, patients are not on a fixed dose, but they get kind of almost pulse dosing based on what their platelet count is. Was the drug able to show, benefit in terms of reduction of platelets? The answer is yes. The question's got to be the what is the long-term benefit, if any, right? Are you preventing patients from clotting? Are you preventing patients from transforming? For a new drug to enter the market, I think those are important questions because, again, you have Hydrea, which is pennies on the dollar, right? It is a relatively cheap drug that can do the job of controlling blood counts. But, does bomedemstat or any of the other emerging agents actually have a biological and long-term clinical effect? Unknown at this time.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Rampal, for your time. We look forward to having you again on our podcast in the future.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.